Hello, and welcome to your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Services Rochester Area Podcast. My name is Jan Heineman, and today I'll be reading to you from the Rochester Beacon. Our first story from the Rochester Beacon is dated October 9th and comes from writer Narm Nathan. New focus on the homelessness crisis. City Council President Melendez last week heard a number of perspectives on homelessness from community associations and advocacy organizations to service and shelter providers. The day of testimony was in preparation for a report on the state of Rochester's unhoused community. Advocates for the homeless often lament the city's role in encampment sweeps, claiming that the action is carried out with little recourse for those who remain impacted after an encampment is dismantled. The city, in contrast, states it offers resources and relocation assistance to the unhoused before using encampment sweeps as a last resort. The forthcoming report appears to be an intentional move for the city to find solutions for the dramatic increases in unsheltered and chronic homelessness throughout Rochester and Monroe County. Advocates, providers, and legislators agree homelessness in Rochester and Monroe County represents a crisis that must be addressed. The report, they say, is an avenue for all involved to explore innovative solutions to tackling citywide homelessness. Melendez says, by virtue of the fact that we've seen it rise in our city, the city has become a little more involved in that space. I think we need to be clearer on what we are doing and not doing. Harsh reality. In the years following the COVID-19 pandemic, Rochester and Monroe County saw a surplus of available beds for the unhoused community. That changed following a rise in homelessness last year. Project Haven, one of two remaining low-barrier shelters in Rochester, closed this March before Open Door Mission relocated all guests at its men's emergency shelter for renovations and expansion. Now, with code blue temperatures fast approaching, Rochester will be left without any low-barrier shelters, where those who are unhoused can find shelter with fewer prerequisites for entry. Anna Valeria, CEO of Open Door Mission, testified before City Council, saying, "We've been kind of forced to take matters into our own hands, whether it's through capital campaigns and repurposing existing space, moving folks around, and establishing new boundaries, because we're being forced to do this." The faith-based shelter organization has seen a 124% increase in emergency shelter nights over the last 5 years. Valeria says that contributing factors that we're seeing are a decrease in available emergency shelter beds and specifically hospitality beds. Shelters that used to take hospitality placements are now saying, no, you have to have DHS approval. We're definitely seeing an increase in untreated addiction, an increase in untreated mental illness, and lack of affordable housing. But we're careful to specify that it's not just subsidized housing. There are so many people who fall through the cracks, who are working, who want to work, but there's nothing affordable for them to be able to independently pay for their own housing. For Andy Carey, co-founder of social work organization MC Collaborative, who's been involved with Project Haven and Reach Advocacy, the organization operating it, the invitation to testify on Rochester's state of homelessness came as a surprise because the perspective and solutions touted, he says, have been long known. Carey explains, when Open Door Mission moves down to 40 or 50 beds, you've already lost 70. You lose the 110 reach beds. We had 80, and then we had 30 more for Code Blue. Those are all gone. I know some other providers will probably step in, but we'll be nowhere near the Code Blue capacity we used to have. Project Haven closed largely due to failures to secure funding between Reach and Monroe County's Department of Human Services, which manages funding for shelters and low-income individuals seeking financial assistance. With New York managing shelter regulations through the Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, Mayor Malik Evans' administration has understood the constraints that exist upon its ability to effectively manage citywide homelessness. Michael Burns, deputy mayor, says, in terms of the relationship between the city and the county, we have a role to play because these unhoused individuals are in our city. I think we're bringing to bear the resources that we have. Person in Crisis Team, RPD, the county, is bringing to bear the resources it has between the Department of Human Services and the Office of Mental Health. While the county and community-based organizations play critical roles in collaborating on solutions for the unhoused community, Burns says he has been deeply involved in addressing citywide homelessness. What I've come to appreciate about what I've learned in being involved in working with our unhoused neighbors is just how complex it is, he says, and just as it is complex, how critical of an issue it is for us to address. But to do so in a way that remembers that each of these individuals is a person. They are somebody's son or daughter. They're somebody's mother or father. They could be somebody's sister or brother. They're not a problem to solve. They're a person to help. Michael Burns maintains that dismantling encampments remains the last resort the city takes. When notified of a new encampment, he says, the city will work to provide resources and outreach to those present before taking action, whether through the Person in Crisis Team or Rochester Police Department's community police officers. Certainly, if the report of the encampment indicates potential public safety concerns, that visit will happen much sooner, Burns says. Once we've determined that there are no safety risks, we'll send in our outreach team, usually our person in crisis team. They will begin a series of engagements with the one or more individuals who are at that location. If services are accepted right away, we'll work to immediately get the person to the place where those services can be delivered. Burns says that process may last 30 to 45 days, depending on the situation. The incentive to dismantle encampments for the city is when their presence poses a risk to public safety. Burns says, if we're working with a person who has been offered all of the support that we as a city government and a county government have, and they are refusing those supports, that is when we have an obligation to intervene. We cannot have individuals living on a lot at a location indefinitely. That is not good for them. That is not good for the neighbors. If we let that go on, we're not adequately addressing the commitment to quality of life that we have, both for the people who live in that neighborhood, as well as our unhoused individuals. In July, encampments near Clinton Avenue and Morrill Street were dismantled in tandem with narcotics-based search warrants after residents raised concerns about living near drug use and needle litter, and the adverse impact outdoor encampments have had on the neighborhood. Melendez says, I think that the struggle here is that obviously everyone in the community wants people who are struggling to do better and to do well and to have opportunities. I can tell you personally, in the last decade, I've picked up thousands of needles personally. I've seen people shoot up in my face out in the open who are struggling with addiction. And it's not to stigmatize that. For Melendez, addressing outdoor encampments requires a delicate balance, holding compassion for those directly impacted while ensuring the city's residents remain in the neighborhoods they can enjoy. Advocates for the unhoused find the critique valid. They say, however, that the burden of responsibility shouldn't fall on those in or near encampments. The city, through increased services, can address those challenges. Amy D'Amico, unhoused advocate and member of the Rochester Grants Pass Resistance, says, the needle litter, for example, can be addressed with sharps boxes. The litter can be addressed with garbage containers. The human waste can be addressed with public bathrooms and porta potties. These are all things our government should be doing. The unhoused aren't the actors, they're the outcome. They're not saying, I want to live outside and be free. Most people who are unhoused have no other options. The Lyle Otis Community Association, Monroe Avenue Revitalization Coalition, and Father Tracy Advocacy Center did not respond to requests for comment. Dealing with a crisis. As the primary community advocacy organization engaged in addressing citywide homelessness, Rochester Grants Pass Resistance collaborated with Melendez long before expert testimonies were heard. In coordination with City Council member Kim Smith and voices of community activists and leaders, RGPR held a series of presentations and focus groups centered on the lived experience of homelessness. Smith notes, we brought in President Melendez over the course of a few meetings. We created a very specific chart of solutions, prevention, intervention, and long-term impact that was presented. The council president then said, yes, I'm committed to standing in solidarity and ready to see something happen. It's important to name that as it relates traditionally to how policies are passed for the most marginalized communities, it is not based on the goodness of the heart of any elected official. It's based on the influence of those on the ground who are meeting with elected officials and urging them to take action. In a focus group of those who were currently or recently unhoused, Melendez and Smith heard from individuals who discussed the impact of a sweep, whether it be the loss of their personal items or the difficulty they faced in retrieving them from the Department of Environmental Services, which holds items following a sweep for up to 30 days. What's interesting is we can connect the stories of the lived experience experts directly to what a lot of the folks who showed up in the expert testimony and what they testified, says Smith. The sweeps are not working. The system has failed to act and give this community what it needs. The current approach to handling encampment sweeps needs reform, sources for this article say. When an encampment is asked to dismantle, says Chuck Albanese, CEO of Person-Centered Housing Options, when an encampment is asked to dismantle or move along or sweep, whatever term you want to plug in there, they're asked to leave that spot and they move and they're offered to go into shelter, But as the research will show, the majority of individuals that are living on the street, for whatever reason, do not do well in a shelter setting. When we're trying to build those relationships to assist people out of that situation, and then they're being asked to move along to wherever, and we lose contact with them, then we have to start all over. According to the National Association of County and City Health Officials, encampment sweeps do little to curb homelessness or improve access to housing. Rather, a majority of those impacted by encampment sweeps often find themselves in similar outdoor situations. In addition, a 2023 study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that unhoused individuals who were regularly forced to relocate experienced 70 to 90% higher rates of death due to overdose. After a recent sweep of an encampment near Monroe Avenue, Candy Perez, who has experienced homelessness and now serves as a neighborhood ambassador in the area, finds the act of a sweep detrimental. Cops are just rolling around, sweeping people, not giving two craps about whether they overdose or not, and if they have anywhere to stay, says Perez. For me, we lose people. With the recent sweeps, we can't find half the people. PCHO, alongside the City Roots Community Land Trust, has been engaged in rebuilding Peace Village through the development of pallet shelters on the property. First designated in 2018, Peace Village was Rochester's only sanctioned encampment before it was razed in RAZED in 2024. The lot has seen a sizable investment in funding from City Council, as the expectation remains that members of the unhoused community will be able to access shelter and support services once construction is complete. Albanese says, "There's just a lot of bureaucratic stuff we're working through. We're still involved and engaged with the city." Smith says, "We haven't prioritized it. That's the problem. The city can do and has done anything that it wants to do. The administration leads the city. Council is the legislative body of the city. If we wanted something done, it would be so. There has not been enough political insistence and demand that this be a priority." Melendez adds, "I'm hopeful that we can get Peace Village back online. I've been pushing the administration on that issue. Ultimately, it's a challenge of whose responsibility it is. And from a budget perspective, we don't get the resources to do this work." Exploring solutions. To tackle homelessness, reforming the relationship Rochester has with Monroe County and New York in terms of resources must be a priority, says Valeria. The city does collaborate extensively with Monroe County on the issue of homelessness, but does not directly interact with the state's Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance, Burns confirms. Valeria says, "It would be nice to have advocates in our elected representatives who are saying, if I really care for this community, then why aren't I advocating for the people who are hurting the most? We're not asking for a ton of funding, honestly. We're just looking for that support." Melinda says, "There's been ongoing discussions between the county and the city administrations on how they might collaborate moving forward, giving a lot of the feedback that we've all received in the community. I think we have to systemically figure out how we can better collaborate. All of us have a role. What I know is that the issue is playing out most prevalently inside the city of Rochester. Exploring the solutions identified by experts, he adds, requires creativity and innovation. Even so, the city has moved forward with a good cause task force that will hold its first meetings this week. That would be the week of October 9th. Melendez says, housing instability, homelessness, you know, depending on which side of the spectrum you talk about, is a concern that I have. And this is why I'm working on trying to better understand it at this point, make some early recommendations that might evolve as things evolve at the federal level or at the state and the county. In addition to reform around shelter regulation and funding, whether through low barrier shelters or bed availability, other solutions highlighted through testimonials include an increase in sanctioned encampments like Peace Village, where individuals facing unsheltered or chronic homelessness can access shelter and support services, and overdose prevention centers, controlled spaces where individuals facing drug addiction can freely use while being directly connected to overdose and addiction services. Carey says, if we can bring someone or a large group of people to an overdose prevention center or to a low barrier shelter, then, as social workers, we have time to use the evidence-based practices that have been proven. We can use motivational interviewing to move people through the states of change, and we can instill some hope, a little bit of optimism. For shelters like the Open Door Mission, which is currently renovating and expanding its emergency shelter capacity, solutions fall under the desire for increased advocacy and collaboration among legislators committed to securing additional resources for shelter providers. The Center for Youth, which has seen 600 street-involved youth under the age of 18 in street outreach, as well as over 1,150 calls to its crisis hotline, Center for Youth views an understanding of youth homelessness as critical to solution building. For advocates like D'Amico and Vocal New York's Lyle Coleman, the issue of citywide homelessness represents a public health issue. A focus on harm reduction services and peer-based outreach, in addition to the idea of overdose prevention centers and sanctioned areas, they say, would have a direct impact on not just the unhoused community, but those who live in proximity to outdoor encampments. Coleman would also like to see a dedicated working group tackling homelessness. Coleman says, "We just know from the research that sweeps are not effective. So why are we spending all this money doing the same thing and hitting our head against the wall? The city could assist grassroots organizations to apply for this money and advocate that the conditions of the money are less restrictive, or pull together a work group of grassroots organizations who want to end homelessness and have us be a steering committee to work on housing, health, and income legislation." Rochester's Grant Pass Resistance Organization has also drafted legislation it aims to collaborate with the city on in an effort to put an end to encampment sweeps through changes to the city municipal code. Smith has stated her intention of working with Melendez on the issue. D'Amico says, "I think if the mayor said no more cleanups, no more sweeps, we don't move people, we don't take their property, we can go and we can clean the area, the ground of litter, but we don't take their property, then that would change it. The mayor has to sign the legislation, so it will also require a mayor who has buy-in to that idea. With just weeks until code blue temperatures reach Rochester, Smith has demanded a more rapid response to address unsheltered and chronic homelessness before the report's release. Smith says, number one, how long is it going to take to generate this report? Number two, how long is it going to take to follow up on the recommendations? Number three, we're going to end up in 2026 before anything is even touched. With funding and resources being a primary barrier, Melendez has stated his commitment to the issue. Through continued discussions with advocates and experts, legislative collaborations with City Council, or the recommendations he will make as a result of the forthcoming report. Melendez says, I'm sure that there will be diverging viewpoints on this. What I'm hopeful for is that we could come up with something that we can agree on. Some of it might be that we, as a council, need to advocate for the state, or we as a council need to advocate to the county, or we need to talk to some of our nonprofit partners in the community about some of the struggles that we've heard and how we can try to do better in addressing this challenge as a community overall. While Smith has reinforced her commitment to grassroots organizing and community advocacy as she concludes her term, she continues to stress the necessity and ability to implement solutions, and that the solutions have existed among those who remain in the community. Melinda says, I don't want to cast blame on anyone. I think I want to find a path towards doing better. That's the goal. Doing better than we're currently doing and figuring out how, from a policy or advocacy or investment standpoint, we as a city can push in a better direction. This story from the Rochester Beacon comes from contributing writer Narm Nathan, and you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon is dated October 14th and comes from writer Justin Murphy. New book brings Kodak's chemical roots into clearer focus. Like A Camera Obscura, Alice Lovejoy's recently published book titled Tales of Militant Chemistry, The Film Factory in a Century of War, presents the Eastman Kodak Company in an unfamiliar and disorienting light. She traces Kodak's mid-century dominance not to George Eastman's brilliance, but to German dye factories, commandeered with the help of friendly military connections, and to the coal fields of the Belgian Congo and the cotton fields of the Carolinas, where the basic ingredients for film were obtained through brutal labor practices. In so doing, she changes the story's main setting from Rochester to Kingsport, Tennessee, where the subsidiary Tennessee Eastman played a key part in the Manhattan Project. As a product of the chemical industry, film is terribly ordinary, writes Lovejoy, who's a film and media historian and a professor at the University of Minnesota. It begins in wood, cotton, and oil, substances that can also end in a bomb or in fuel for a warship, like film, essential products of the 20th century. The places where film was made were both part of a dream factory, or simply factories. Tales of Militant Chemistry, published in August by the University of California Press, picks up Kodak's story in the mid-1910s, when the company was at a crossroads. The federal government had opened an antitrust investigation that changed the trajectory of the company's expansion plans. Rather than buying up rival camera and film manufacturers, it began to accelerate its strategy for vertical integration, gaining control over the sources of the raw materials it needed. One such product was wood, which is the key ingredient in methanol, which is needed to churn out cellulose acetate, without which safety film, motion picture film that did not risk combustion, as its predecessor cellulose nitrate did, could not be made. And so Kodak bought a plant in the town of Kingsport. Like Rochester, Kingsport was a company town, devoutly non-unionized and largely dependent on the vision of one man. George Eastman visited in person and noted approvingly that Kingsport had about, quote, 10,000 inhabitants, only one of which is a foreigner. Through a series of market disruptions and chemists' innovations, Kingsport would eventually become the home of Tennessee Eastman, one of the nation's most prolific wartime chemical manufacturers. Now known as Eastman Chemical Company, it was spun off from Kodak in 1994. Other raw materials had to be procured from farther afield. Kodak and other manufacturers got uranium and other elements from mines in the Belgian Congo, where miners dug them out with hand tools under forced labor conditions and with minimal safety precautions. Lovejoy compares Kodak to Agfa, a German competitor that also turned its production capacity to military ends. At the end of World War II, Kodak and other companies raced into France and Germany to survey for raw materials, manufacturing equipment, and specialized knowledge they could turn to profit. After 1945, the story returns to Tennessee. Kingsport is about 125 miles from Oak Ridge, the administrative headquarters of the Manhattan Project. Kodak employees served as key technical advisors in research into military uses for uranium and plutonium. When nuclear fallout fell together with lake effect snow in Rochester in November 1951, causing black spots on film, the company helped conceal the potential health risks. Lovejoy also recalls an incident in 1988 when a pipe burst near Kodak Park, sending 30,000 gallons of industrial solvent spilling out into the surrounding neighborhood. She quotes a Kodak spokesman at a meeting of concerned School 41 parents, giving an offhanded comment that could serve as an epigraph for the book. Quote, "We've never been thought of as a chemical company. We just made the yellow boxes," unquote. A scholarly book about international chemical manufacturing, full of proper German nouns, inevitably risks running aground in details. Lovejoy, despite her best efforts, does not always avoid this risk. Rochester readers expecting a book for their local history shelves may grow impatient with the pages Lovejoy dedicates to Tennessee, Berlin, and other far-off places. Nonetheless, the book is valuable for the very different light it shines on a part of the Kodak Empire that from the company seat has always looked like a far-off province. The book closes with a mention of Kodak's venture into pharmaceutical production in 2020 to be fueled by a $765 million federal government loan that got derailed by suspicions of insider trading. At the time, the old film company seemed like a questionable fit for the loan. As Lovejoy points out, though, Kodak was always more than a film company. Its subsidiaries produced chemicals for pharmaceuticals starting in the 1930s. Her contribution is to bring that misperception into clearer focus. This story from the Rochester Beacon comes from contributing writer Justin Murphy, and you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier radio reading service. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon is a guest opinion following up on a story that we read here on Niagara Frontier radio reading service last summer about the expulsion of an Eastman student from the U of R. This story is dated October 14th and comes from Jesse Appleby and William Harris. U of R won't explain why an Eastman student was expelled. Picture yourself at one of the most elite music schools in the country. You've earned your place after years of training, won the orchestra's vote of confidence, and devoted your life to mastering one of the demanding art forms on earth. Now, picture your shock and surprise when you report your professor for harassment and the school that promised to nurture your talent turns on you. You press for accountability. You speak out publicly. But instead of support, you face threats, isolation, and finally expulsion. That's exactly what happened to Rebecca Bryant Novak, who until this year was pursuing a doctorate in conducting at the University of Rochester's Eastman School of Music. And months later, the university is still ducking the most basic questions about why it abandoned its own rules to drive her out. Rebecca's case is about more than music. It's about free speech, due process, and how far powerful institutions will go to avoid accountability. In October 2023, Rebecca reported Eastman's director of orchestras, Neil Varon, for alleged harassment. According to Rebecca and the university's own investigative findings, the school mishandled her complaint at every turn. The university admitted in a letter to Rebecca that, quote, the transparency, process, procedures, and resources deployed to address your complaints in this matter were inconsistent with university policy and practice and warrant improvement. Yet, when Rebecca published her account of the incident and this mishandling on her Substack newsletter, retaliation ensued. The threat of a defamation suit, hostility from peers, and dwindling performance opportunities. Then, in December 2024, Eastman expelled her for, quote, lack of academic progress, unquote, despite previously confirming that she was on track for graduation. The school's letter tacked on vague accusations about her conduct, but made clear those weren't the actual grounds for dismissal and were irrelevant to its claim about her academic work. To Rebecca, and to anyone familiar with the university's policies, the message was clear. Her expulsion was pretextual punishment for speaking out. At the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, we called out the university for violating its own rules. Under its academic progress policy, students must receive warnings, probation, and an appeal process before dismissal. This policy is supposed to give students notice and a full year to correct things before dismissal occurs. Rebecca got none of those safeguards. We wrote to the university in June demanding that it correct this violation of due process. We weren't alone. Over 790 members of the public signed on to our Take Action campaign, pressing the university to reinstate Rebecca. The university's response? Delay, evasion, and denial. First, the university said it needed months to respond. Then it blew its own deadline. Then it told FIRE, F-I-R-E, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, it wouldn't respond to our letter at all, only to the New York State Division of Human Rights, where Rebecca had filed a formal complaint. Finally, when it eventually did respond to the division, it opened with this stunning line, quote, "We have not attempted to rebut, straighten out, or even mention each of the complainant's misleading allegations in her exceedingly lengthy complaint," unquote. In other words, the university won't explain itself to FIRE, won't explain itself to the public, and won't even explain itself to the state. Up until this point, the university has avoided substantively commenting on the case. Now that they have, it's clear they won't answer for the charge of retaliation, Rebecca lodged with DHR. Instead, the university used its response to DHR to assassinate her character. But Rebecca's story is not about whether she was a perfect student, a colleague, or conductor. It's about whether powerful institutions can ignore their own rules and silence those who challenge them. In July, when the Rochester Beacon reported on FIRE's letter and Rebecca's DHR complaint, it seemed that the university was going to be held accountable by FIRE, DHR, or both, but now it's clear that U of R administrators don't think they need to answer to anyone, not to their students, not to the public, and not to their own policies on free speech, academic progress, and retaliation. When universities expel whistleblowers on flimsy pretexts, then shrug off public scrutiny and legal process, what message does that send to the next student who considers reporting harassment? It's this: speaking up is a liability. Rules only apply when it suits a university. Accountability is optional. The DHR process is moving slowly. So far, the division has received Rebecca's initial complaint and the U of R's response, and have just confirmed receipt of her rebuttal, which she submitted last week. They told her an investigator will be assigned, and that step may take several months. Rebecca is exploring her legal remedies, but the reality is, if people don't demand a sense of accountability and fairness, there's only so far legal remedies can go in addressing the culture of silence at Eastman. This is bigger than one student. The university's refusal to answer basic questions about its treatment of Rebecca is a warning to anyone who dares speak out against misconduct in higher education. The university must be held accountable. The Board of Trustees, alumni, and the wider public should demand answers. Join us and tell the University of Rochester to stop muzzling its students. This guest opinion to the Rochester Beacon comes from Jesse Appleby, who is a program counsel at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, and William Harris, who is the Strategic Campaigns Specialist at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. If you'd like to join FIRE in its campaign, you can visit their website at thefire.org. And this guest opinion to the Rochester Beacon is being heard on your Niagara Frontier radio reading service. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon comes from writer Gary Craig and is dated October 15th. Judge okays controversial Oak Hill membership meeting. This post is one in a partnership between the Rochester Beacon and veteran reporter Gary Craig, featuring articles published on his Substack site. A judge has given the green light for a controversial membership meeting at the Oak Hill Country Club this evening, October 15th. That would be last evening at the time of this reading. At the meeting, members can vote on whether its Board of Governors should be overhauled, with some members jettisoned from the board should the club lose a lawsuit brought by retired businessman Eugene Baldino and other Oak Hill members. State Supreme Court Justice Daniel Doyle ruled Tuesday, that would be October 14th, that the club, which wanted him to declare the special meeting legally void, was asking him to step deeper into club activities than the law allows. Doyle wrote, "This court does not have the jurisdiction to act as sole governor and dictate to the membership what actions it should or should not take as it navigates the challenges Oak Hill faces during this litigation." Doyle wrote that he understands the outcome of the vote could lead to more litigation, but that the club, the Board of Governors, and its attorneys have asked him to take steps precluded by the law. More bad behavior allegations. At the core of Baldino's lawsuit is an allegation that he was improperly booted from the board and that the board wrongly represented what happened in his interaction with the club restaurant manager. The club found his behavior coarse, rude, harassing, and antithetical to the club's disciplinary code, while Baldino and the former manager herself alleged that the interaction was not accurately portrayed in an internal investigation from the club. Baldino alleges that he was ousted because he was fighting for more transparency of club finances. The continuing flurry of legal motions and responses is starting to portray Oak Hill as more of an off-the-rails reality show than as a revered club in international golf circles. The good news, the lawsuit has not deterred the club from landing the PGA Championship in 2035. There are allegations of a governor allowing underage drinking at an off-site event, getting ejected after a physical altercation elsewhere, and then breaking the front door window of the establishment on exit. Another former member of the board is alleged to have engaged in, quote, a loud profanity-laced argument in front of other members, unquote, as he accused other members of wrongly playing ahead of him on the Oak Hill course. These allegations arise from those suing the club as proof, court papers say, of inequitable disciplinary treatment, with Baldino unfairly singled out. Deposition partly sealed. In a separate ruling Tuesday, Doyle agreed that some portions of a recent deposition of former Oak Hill Board President Robert Sansone should be blocked from public release. Among the portions to be sealed are instances in which Sansone has no knowledge of incidents he was questioned about, and sections that could fall under attorney-client privilege protections. Lawyers for Sansone and the club had requested the sealing of the entire 7-hour deposition, which was videotaped. The costs of the lawsuit, which may have to be covered by club members, is well into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. One of the proposals set for a vote at the special meeting, that would be the night of October 15th, is formation of a special committee which could research possible insurance coverage for legal costs, the need for a special club fee, and, quote, the extent to which legal fees may need to be borne by the respondents, unquote. Those being the directors who are being sued. Gary Craig writes, look for a future Substack about the outcome of the vote, assuming I'm able to learn the results. And as I said recently, there will be a hiatus of sorts shortly. More on that next week. So we'll hope to get further information from contributor Gary Craig on the next steps in this Oak Hill Country Club story. This story comes from contributing writer Gary Craig, who has a Substack blog in which he reports on stories with Rochester relevance. He's a retired Democrat and Chronicle reporter, and he writes on Substack. If you want to read more from Gary Craig, whom you might remember as a writer for the DNC, you can go to substack.com and search for Gary Craig, C-R-A-I-G. And you're listening to stories here from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier radio reading service. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon is a contribution to the Beacon's series called Counterpoint. And the contributors are liberal Rick Dollinger and conservative Jeff Rosenberger. In this article, they discuss two views on charter schools. This post is the first in a new Beacon feature called Counterpoint. Rick starts off, that's Rick Dollinger, he's the liberal on this side of the discussion. Jeff, let's start with an old argument that has new data and evolving questions. Charter schools, both as a concept and here in Rochester. I know you're a fan. Jeff Rosenberger, representing the conservative side, responds, you're right, I am. I don't like monopolies, which is what traditional K-12 district schools are. Sure, you can move to a different school district if you have enough money and aren't happy with your child's school, but many people don't. And even if you do have the resources, you love your house, you love your neighbors, and you live 10 minutes from work. Why should you be forced to give that all up because you aren't happy with your child's school? Rick says, I get the dissatisfaction by parents when schools are not teaching their children, but it is more than just the type of school. As you know, it's a host of other systemic problems, poverty most significantly. How do charter schools solve or even deal with that incredibly difficult problem? And Jeff responds from the conservative side, actually, the vast majority of charter schools, at least in New York, primarily enroll students from lower income backgrounds. New York encourages that. I doubt an application for a Pittsford or Penfield domiciled charter school would receive approval. The academic challenges stemming from poverty, as you note, are real and plague charter and urban district schools alike. Homelessness and hunger occupy both their classrooms. But charter schools aren't one size fits all. Each one is different and employs its own pedagogy. Some are strict and emphasize discipline, others less so. Some are single sex, some are co-ed, some focus on science or the arts. Some are more generalist in terms of their curriculum. Some emphasize college prep, others on alternate career pathways. But one of the recurring themes among charters is a longer school day and sometimes a longer school year. Rick Dollinger responds from the liberal side, Jeff, right on the nose. Longer school days, longer school years are proven, to the best I know, to improve student outcomes in every grade. In addition, the wraparound programs, after-school tutoring or organized activities, attain the same goal of increased student investment in their education. The public schools in our region, especially in the suburban districts, are working to make that a reality, as I understand. But a central question is there longitudinal data, historical review of charter school students' success after they graduate or move on, that shows charter schools get over the poverty hurdle and their graduates can get into college and postgraduate success? Jeff responds, Rick, charter schools are public schools. It's a common misperception that they aren't. Your outcomes question is very appropriate. We should be asking that question about every aspect of government, given that A, New York State only first approved charter schools in 1998, and B, it took a few years after that legislative approval for the first charter schools to open. And C, most charter schools only open with one or two grades, adding additional grades each year. The vast majority of charter school students are either still in school or are in the very early stages of their careers. So it's still too early to measure postgraduate success. However, if you look at the standardized English language arts and math exams that the New York State administers to third through eighth grade public school students annually, traditionally three quarters of New York's charter schools outperform their local home district counterparts. But your question does touch a nerve. Longitudinal K-12 academic outcomes data is hard to come by in New York because the standardized English language arts and math exams administered annually to third through eighth grade students are modified every few years by just enough to render the new version's results non-comparable to those from prior years. So, while you can compare your home district to the New York State average each year or to other local school districts with the same poverty metrics, it's difficult to know if statewide educational outcomes as a whole are getting better or worse over time. One has to wonder if that's not by design. Rick responds, Jeff, that argument, how to get good achievement data for schools, whether charter or otherwise, misses the point. As you know, some charter schools in Rochester have proven records of success. Others did not and closed. But the big question, from my point of view, we have 20 years of charter school data in New York, which means that some students from charter schools in school districts which have high concentrations of poverty, like Rochester, have graduated from high school and presumably college. Is the graduation rate of those students markedly higher than the regular public schools? Even if Rochester does not have it, is there national data that proves that point? Don't we need that to settle this argument? Do we even have data from the urban-suburban program in Monroe County, in which students voluntarily shift school districts in an effort to broaden educational opportunity? Jeff responds, Rick, you've highlighted one of the things I like most about charter schools. The lousy ones get closed. Unlike underperforming district schools that are allowed to muddle on year after year, charter schools either produce positive student outcomes or New York State pulls their charter. In fact, 56 New York State charters, or 13.7% of the total, have closed over the years. As you noted, some of those operated in Rochester. Rick responds, the data looks really good and confirms that an available alternative is something every community should examine seriously. But why hasn't your party, the GOP, fielded a charter school slate in the city to give parents a real chance to examine charter school reform and let the voters decide? Jeff responds, well, setting aside the reality that the GOP has zero clout within Rochester City limits, the city's parents have already voted. The RCSD's 25 to 26 budget book shows that 30% of the city's K-12 public school students already attend charter schools. That number will continue to grow as Rochester's newer charter schools continue to add grades with every successive school year. Rick says, Jeff, I get it. People vote with their feet. If they can't move out to the suburbs, they walk to the nearest charter school. So be it. Rick ends with, let's leave the debate here. The parents will decide the future of charter schools when deciding the best interests of their children. I leave it to the parents. We all should let them decide on the best way to educate their children. This story comes from the Rochester Beacon. It's a conversation between Richard Dollinger, who is a retired Court of Claims judge and a former state senator who lives in Brighton, and Jeff Rosenberger, who is retired co-founder of Clover Capital Management Incorporated. And you've been listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. My name is Jan Heineman. Thank you for listening today, and hope you have a chance to listen again in the future.